You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner, number 314, entitled Physiology and Healing, Treatment, Therapy, and Hygiene, 13 lectures and some question and answer sections as well, translated by Anna Moise. This is lecture 8, given in Stuttgart on the 28th of October, 1922. All I can do, really, is to give you some of the methods with a view to therapeutic aims as they arise from spiritual scientific studies. It will, of course, not be possible to go into detail, time being short. However, I think that for starting the work that needs to be done with the aid of spiritual science in the medical direction, it is above all important that the points of view emerge fairly clearly. I may say that with regard to individual special aspects, these points of view have been applied with great care in making our medicines. It may not be immediately obvious how these more general points of view can be developed in specific instances, but I will endeavor, particularly in discussing the methods today, to point out some things that will at least give you thought also in this direction. It will not be possible to understand the human organism in health and sickness, or rather, for today's purposes, in its state of health and gaining of health, unless you take account of the fact that normal, in quotes, functions essentially are but metamorphoses also of those we must evoke in order to meet pathological states. We must always take into account that the human organism is inwardly filled with processes which are not the same as the processes in the outside world. Let us first of all take into account that everything people take in from outside, from the plant world, for instance, must first be processed in the digestive tract itself, so that the human being may then enliven it further. Vitalizing, enlivening must be the human being's own activity. And the human organism simply could not exist if it did not perform this activity. Now we must clearly understand that the earth's plant cover is essentially going through the opposite process from the one inside the human being. When we refer to, in quotes, vitalizing, on the route which human food follows through the organism, on an ascending curve, as it were, a curve rising from essentially inorganic matter to vitalized live matter, from there to what can be the vehicle for sentience, and finally, from there to what can be the vehicle for the I organization, that is, when we speak of food being processed until it is also taken up into the astral organism, the vehicle for the world of sentience, we have to speak of the progressive enlivening of matter taken in as food. In plants, the opposite is the case. Initially, there is essentially a process of devitalization in all peripheral organs as the plant develops from below upward, calling forth the leaf process and the corolla process. The vital principle is retained for the seed only. In the plant which we are first addressing, for when we address the seed in the ovary, we are really already addressing the next plant, which is still to develop. That is, we are addressing something saved for the next plant. We do not have a vitalizing process going up from below. The vitality is sucked out of last year's summer warmth stored in the soil, out of last year's power of sunlight. The greatest vitality is in the root element. We have a gradual devitalization process from below upward. And when we come to the petals, especially petals containing much volatile oil, we also have the most powerful devitalization process in those plants. We have a process which is very frequently, for instance, connected with genuine processing of sulfur, which is then found in material form in the volatile oil, or at least close to the volatile oil in the flower. The sulfur really brings the process about, taking the plant into the volatile, inorganic sphere. I'd say, into the kind of inorganic quality that still has the organic, live quality adhering to it. It is extraordinarily important that we clearly understand what we are actually introducing into our organism, even as we introduce the plant. The plant is going through a process which is the opposite of the process in the human organism. If you base yourself on this, as you focus on the actual disease, you'll have to say to yourself, plant nature, and this also holds true for other substances in the outside world, and to a much higher degree for animal nature, is the opposite of the human organism's tendency to evoke one process or another. Looking in an unbiased way at human nutrition, we cannot but say to ourselves, with every food, we are actually introducing something into the human organism which needs to be thoroughly reversed. Essentially, taking nourishment is always a first step toward poisoning ourselves. When we speak of actual poisoning, we have to be clear in our minds that this is merely a metamorphosis, greatly tending to be radical, of something which happens a little bit when we are all together taking food into the tyalin, let us say. And the further stages of digestion, especially in the renal function of which I spoke, absolutely are always a process of detoxification. We are thus simply going through a rhythm of mild poisoning and detoxification when we eat our daily bread and digest our food. This is the slightest metamorphosis of something which is then enhanced when we introduce medicines into the organism. It is, of course, utterly senseless to fall into raptures about, quote, non-toxic medicine, close quote. It is nonsense, because the question can only be, how do we enhance something which is already happening in ordinary digestion by introducing something which is more foreign than ordinary nourishment to the human organism? We need to understand the human organism really well to be in a position to appreciate the value of an external medicament for this organism. Let us take something which is really always present in the human organism as a medicinal agent, the iron in our blood. This is really always playing the role of a medicament, protecting us from the tendency to fall ill which we have in us. I'll start by putting this the most primitive way. As you know, if the brain, weighing 1,500 grams, were to rest on the base of the brain, the vessels in the brain base would, of course, be squashed. The brain does not rest on that base, but actually floats in the cerebrospinal fluid. Due to the law of buoyancy, it loses as much weight as the displaced fluid weighs, so that the pressure the brain exerts on the brain base is only about 20 grams, and not 1,500 grams. This is a fact of principal importance, for it simply shows that gravity is not the effective principle behind functions of the brain, such as I activity, capital I. This I activity, and largely also idea-forming activity, insofar as it is not will activity, I am now definitely referring to the physical correlate, brain activity, does not rest on the weight of the physical matter involved, but on buoyancy. It depends on the force that seeks to remove matter from the earth. With our eye and our thoughts, we are not living in gravity, but indeed in buoyancy. Here, this is particularly apparent as we consider the matter in this way. The principle that applies to the brain does essentially also apply to many other things in the human organism. Above all, it applies to the red blood cells, which contain iron. These float in the serum, and each of them loses as much of its weight as the displaced serum weighs. Consider this. If we altogether live in buoyancy in our souls, what it means for the whole way we feel and altogether live the whole of life in the human organism, if we have a greater or smaller number of red blood cells containing iron inside us. In other words, if we understand in a given case that what is happening in the blood simply due to the buoyancy of those blood cells is not in order, we will know that we must supply iron in some way, and this will make it possible for the iron to unfold its activity properly in the blood and not to be used in some other kind of way. In spiritual scientific terms, this means that we are dealing with the iron level in the blood as far as the relationship of the etheric to the astral organism is concerned. If you understand how heart and lung function transfers everything taken in by the human being into vitalization, that renal function then takes it into the astral organism, you will not be that far away from realizing that this needs balance. When etheric activity or astral activity gets too powerful, and there is no balance, the whole organism must fall into disorder. The way of producing this balance, giving the organism the possibility of transferring just as much of the food into renal function as is necessary, is to regulate the iron level in the blood. Since you give either gravity or buoyancy to the actual dynamics in the blood, depending on how you regulate the iron level, you are regulating the whole blood circulation, which in turn influences renal function. And in transmitting iron or taking it away, you have a major regulator for the blood circulation function, that is, the interrelationship between the human etheric and astral organism. Let us now apply this by considering something specific. Let us assume we detect flatulence, wind, as a first symptom in the human organism. I am choosing the most primitive things here so that we may understand one another. What does flatus mean to someone who fully understands the human organism? It means that there are air organizations in the person in which the astral organism is strongly present, which do not dissolve rapidly enough. This is an effect of the astral organism, which is active in the gaseous, the airy human being. Activities of the astral organism are present in the individual, which do not develop and dissolve in the regular way, but accumulate. We then have a preponderance of astral organizational activity coming to physical expression in the aeriform human being. This is what we have if there is flatulence. Being too powerful, astral activity affects all our sensory functions, especially the functions of the head. Because astral activity does not spread properly through the organism, but congeals, it does not act properly into the metabolism, but rebounds onto the neurosensory system, being more closely related to it. And we will very soon find that the neurosensory system is not functioning properly either, or at least assume that we have a syndrome partly consisting in that the neurosensory system is also not functioning properly. At this point, I have to say something relating to a neurosensory system that is not functioning properly. A lot of mischief goes on in physiology where the neurosensory system is concerned. Forgive me, there is no ill intent. You have to take everything with a familiar grain of salt, of course. If I am too compromising, we'll understand one another less well. Permit me, therefore, to put things in radical terms. Seen from the supersensible point of view, If we consider any function which we are able to demonstrate empirically, using our senses, it will, from such a higher point of view, be the sense-perceptible reflection of something which exists in the spirit. The whole human organism is the sense-perceptible image of something spiritual. However, interaction between spirit and soul, on the one hand, and the physical organic element in the human organism, on the other, certainly is not as easy to comprehend as we tend to imagine for the neurosensory system. The reason is that if we consider only the human physical organization, things are not the way one would like to assume with the physical organization as a whole, as it were, excepting the nervous system and the senses. And the nervous system is embedded in this structure and functioning separately to serve only the psyche. It is not seen in such radical terms, of course, but if we then base our practical considerations on our theory of the physical, then this is pretty well what we get. This is why there is hardly any possibility of forming a sensible idea on, quote, functional diseases, close quote, as they are called today, nervous disorders, and so on. There is not anything in the human organism that is not part of the whole organism and interacting with other organs. There is no separate nervous system, so that the organism takes care of itself with the nervous system embedded in it, who knows by which divine spirit, so that it may be a soul. Look for proof. You'll find it in a trice. Primarily, the nervous system is the origin of configuring, rounding powers in the human organism, as I mentioned yesterday. The shape of your nose, the shape of your whole organism, is essentially configured from the nervous system. The renal system sends out the powers of matter radially, and the nervous system is there to give the organism its forms, both inwardly and outwardly. Initially, it has nothing to do with the psyche. It configures, shapes the human organism, inwardly and outwardly. It is the sculptor. In the early stages of individual human development, a particular part of nerve function separates off. The organism does not use it for its own configuration, and the psyche adapts to this part, secondarily, gradually adapting more and more. If one notes how a piece of the nerve process is torn out in the early years of childhood, and how soul life adapts to these configuring principles, one will then have the actual empirical state of affairs. There truly is no question of the nervous system needing to be incorporated into the organism by some council of gods, and has to be the basis for life in the will, in feelings and thoughts. There is simply no question of this. The life in senses and nerves is born with a kind of hypertrophy. Some of this is taken out, and soul activity then adapts to this saved part, whilst the primary function in the neurosensory system is configuration. All organs are configured from the neurosensory system. If you wish to verify this empirically, start with the senses located in the skin, spread out over the whole skin, with the sense of warmth, the sense of touch, and try to see how these senses cause the whole modeling of the human organism, whereas other senses configure to the form of specific organs. Even our ability to see depends on some of the configuring power originating in the visual tract to develop the cerebral organs being left over, with the soul qualities we develop in our power of vision, adapting to it. We must first see things properly in this area. Otherwise, we won't be in any position to understand the human being properly, for we simply won't know that with metabolism in progress, day by day, year by year, our organs must in the first place be provided all the time with the principles sent out from the kidneys with the radial principle, and that the organs must then be rounded out, modeled, Throughout life, this comes from the nerve organs, which extend from the senses to the inner human organism. The psyche simply adapts to this one organ tract, and this allows higher sensory functions and the forming of ideas to arise. This will demonstrate to us that when, on the one hand, we have flatulence in the syndrome, and with this establish that the astral organization is too powerful, this excessive power of the astral organization moves things toward the configuring power of the senses, so that toward the periphery and upward in the human organism, it is not only that astral activity is dammed up and pushed together, but these bubbles of gas, which really want to turn into organs, are rounded off. In other words, overpowerful renal function means that the attempt is continually made in the upper human being to hold the eye organization back in the upward direction from letting anything entering into the organism via the blood remain behind in the given way. With the complex of which I am speaking, we will therefore frequently see spasms associated, which are due to the fact that the astral is not entering into the rest of the organism in the right way. When it comes to a halt up above, it will not enter into the rest of the organism. We note spasmodic phenomena in the rest of the organism, always due to the fact that the astral is staying behind. It stays behind in this case. And when we inwardly look at such a syndrome, initially with the help of the supersensible, we can relate the things we see outwardly to what we have seen inwardly. Consider, the astral is up above, held back, and this causes the whole metabolism to be drawn upward. The astral body will then not provide properly for the renal organs and above all the stomach. The stomach, getting too little from the astral organization, defends itself. Outwardly, you'll see colics and gastric spasms, or characteristic spasms will develop in the sexual organs because they are not fully and properly organized by the astral, or periods are delayed or stopped because eye activity is held back up above. We now ask ourselves what we can do about such irregularities. You see, it is really best if we understand that the magical names we give to diseases actually only serve as labels for conventional communication. And what matters is that we do indeed everywhere see what individual symptoms come together and actually group together and one into the other. We must, however, be able to rate these symptoms. Consider, therefore, that we now look to the function which is attached, as it were, to a flower that contains sulfur. What I want to say is that when we have a flower that contains some sulfur, this means that a very powerful process is going into the inorganic, with the organic still attached to it. If we now introduce such a flower, or even just the sulfur produced from such a flower, into the human organism as a medicine, we are above all calling on everything that happens in the digestive tract to be more active. We call on it to be more active. The plant is essentially going through a devitalization process, as I said before, which has to be reversed. A tea of flowers containing sulfur stimulates the stomach and particularly also intestinal activity. As a result, the irregularity which has developed in renal activity is indirectly challenged to react strongly. And it is possible for us, perhaps only temporarily, for the things that act in this way are generally only temporary, but if we help the organism for a time, it will in most cases come to help itself, to balance out this delay or stoppage in the upward direction by means of powerful downward counter-pressure, calling the astral organization back into the digestive tract again, as it were. and this is evident in that the colics and stomach cramps disappear. This will only rarely be enough on its own, however. It may be enough when the gastric spasms are mild. We should never overstimulate the organism when a gentler medicine will do. Never use a more powerful one. Let us assume we have a syndrome of the kind I have been describing. And as the disorder is severe, we first want to direct our attention to the fact that powerful renal activity is making demands on an excessively active astral body, which exerts a powerful influence on the sensory organization, weakening and undermining it in a way. It is not, in fact, undermined as sensory organization, but the influence of the astral organism is so powerful that the configuring power of the neurosensory organization is drowned out just by the astral organism being active. The sense organs, or the neurosensory organization altogether, is not less active, but it is not active in its own true function as neurosensory organization. Instead, it is, as it were, assuming the organization of the astral organism and functions in the way the astral organism itself functions. That is, it does not perform its sculpting action in the right way. We have to use something that will get the astral activity out of the neurosensory organization. We can do this in no other way but by using something which acts on the neurosensory organization, which, after all, relates to the outside world most of all, and as an organization is also in the human being most related to the inorganic. The physiology of the senses is in a happy position, because many things in the sense organs can be explained in inorganic, that is, purely physical or at most also chemical terms. Consider how much in the eye, EYE, is sheer optics. You can make nice drawings if you take the eye to be a kind of camera. I merely want to indicate here how we relate to the outside world, especially through our sense organs, how we have bays in our sense organs, through which the outside world extends into us, particularly through the inorganic. If we need to support this specific activity of senses and nerves, we can do this very well with a principle which is introduced into the human organism as silica, for silica has an affinity to this inorganic element in the periphery. We drive the astral organization out, as it were, with the principle which exactly in everything that underlies silica moves so extraordinarily powerfully to the inorganic, also externally. If you find silica in a flower, you'll always discover that the flower grows spiny, that it moves strongly toward the inorganic. In this way, we can relieve the sense organs, on the one hand, with this silica principle, and on the other by providing the organism in such a state with more sugar than it usually has. Sugar also is a substance processed in the human organism in a way where the process is closest to the inorganic. Everything introduced into the body as sugar will also relieve the sense organs. If you are also able to do so, you can support this further by introducing alkaline salts. These relieve the nervous system, in particular, of astral activity. These things need to be demonstrated in a series of empirical experiments. Spiritual science thus makes it possible to arrive at regulative principles, for in the activity which develops as we gain in intuitive insight, for instance, we see the after effects of sugar quite specifically in the parts of the human nervous system that go from the central nervous system to the sense organs. Seeing the after effects of silica, we see that it actually tends toward the peripheral quality which develops in the senses. These things can be verified, checked. Medicines simply made of alkaline salts, which powerfully relieve nerve functions of astrality, made of sugar, which, of course, must not be given in the usual amounts, but in unusual ones, to which I will refer in a minute, and silica are all effective when the syndrome to which I've been referring is present to a high degree. The substances to which I have just been referring are best made into medicines by simply making a suitable decoction of chamomile root. You might think it strange that I am referring specifically to the root. But the points of view cross, and we have to understand that when the symptoms are powerful, we have least need of sulfur or anything taken from the floral organization. What we do need is something still very vital in the plant, so that a long road must be followed to make the counteraction strong enough. If we introduce the characteristic substances contained in chamomile root into the digestive tract in suitable dosage, the counteraction is not strong enough in this case to make vitalization occur at the transition from intestine to blood. Instead, the principle inherent above all in sugar and silica, and also in the alkaline salts, is simply pushed through, unprocessed. This gives renal function the opportunity to take it up into its radiations, so that renal function makes the substances thus received act toward the neural and sensory functions. This relieves neural and sensory activities of the astral functions concerned. If we understand such things, actually see how to proceed with treatment in such a way, and this is the healthiest way of working, such a course of events can teach us a great deal. We can then easily be guided toward other things. We can see, as it were, how something taken up into the human organization is transformed there, how renal function then comes into play, which really takes up what the blood channels bring to it and lets it radiate out, how sculpting activity then acts back on it, how this sculpting activity is produced in pure form by silica, sugars, and alkaline salts. One would like to say that, from the supersensible point of view, seen intuitively, silica, alkaline salts, and sugars create a kind of human phantom. We have something like a phantom before us when we envisage the creative powers of these substances. For they are, above all, sculptors, having sculpting in them. Gaining this insight, this becomes clear to us even at the level of external physical configuration. The powerful effect of silica is in the first place due to the fact that silica tends to occur as long crystals in the inorganic field. We would not be able to achieve what it is possible to achieve with silica using other substances, as these tend to form more rounded rather than elongated crystals. One might be able to cure a hedgehog with them, but not a human being, the growth principle of the latter tending toward elongation. You have to have a feeling for this artistic tendency in nature, which configures the organism mainly out of neural and sensory activity, or you will not be able to find rationally the connections between outside substances and processes in the human organism. But there is such a rational treatment, where one simply sees both what is going on outside and how it is broken down in the human organism, where renal activity can radiate it out, and it can be taken over by the sculpting activity of the neurosensory organism. Let us take some other example. Let us assume that instead of excessive, overpowering kidney radiation, we have renal function that is too weak. That is, too little of the food substance is absorbed into the astrality. Everything I said about the previous syndrome comes from action into the astral organism being too powerful. The astral organism is active in the upper human being, and holds back from digestive activity, heart activity, lung activity. Mucus congestion develops alongside this syndrome, and so do other things which you can easily establish. So that is the situation with excessive astral activity. Let us assume we are dealing with the opposite, with astral activity that is too weak. Renal activity is not radiating enough, and the human astral organism actually is not in a position to provide what it is meant to provide for the configuring power striking into it. The configuring power cannot work its way in as far as the astral organism. That organism does not adequately reach the periphery, and there is therefore no lively contact between configuring power and the power of circulating foods, matter, the distribution of matter. The matter is distributed, but not utilized by the configuring power. The modeling, sculpting power is reduced. Matter is left to its own life. The astral body stays too volatile, does not properly enter into the processing of matter. You see, we may also look at such a thing as a syndrome. What will it be like, this syndrome? Well, above all, the matter in the blood channels is not taken up properly by a weak renal function, that is, an astral organization functioning at a low level, so that the astral organization is not working adequately. The matter drops down, as it were. Hemorrhoids develop. Heavy periods develop. There is no contact, and the metabolism deteriorates in itself. When this situation exists in the organism, a kind of occult febrile condition may very easily develop, and even intermittent fevers. Now, you see, it is like this. How do we deal with such a syndrome? The activity of the astral organism is too weak. We have to stimulate renal function so that it allows sufficient matter to be absorbed into the astral organism. Something arises here to which I referred earlier. The best thing is to establish a balance between etheric and astral organism. This will simply give us the right transition to renal activity from what enters into the system of heart and lungs from the digestive tract. We get a kind of balance, but we can actually regulate it in very many cases by regulating the iron level in the organism. The iron level regulates the circulation in that it now actually provokes powerful inner renal activity. This can be demonstrated in physical terms as a change in urea elimination through the kidneys and also in the sweat on the skin. It will certainly be possible to demonstrate this. In very many cases, we must, of course, understand that this balance is always extraordinarily unstable, and the medicinal agent in question, which is already in us, really helps only in the grossest cases. Yet whilst things which in some way contain sulfur are helpful in the digestive tract, and substances such as silica and alkaline salts are mainly helpful in the neurosensory system, which we now consider to be the configuring principle, it is the pure metals which serve to regulate the balance between gravity and buoyancy in the right way. We merely have to try and see how we must use them in order to maintain the upset balance in all kinds of different ways, starting with iron. Sometimes it will be gold, sometimes copper, depending on the nature of the syndrome. But when we are held fast here by the type of illness in the human organism, pure metals will allow us to achieve the most important results. And if it is a matter of the interrelationship between form-giving and deformation, being such that there is too little form-giving and it becomes organic, if initially this relationship between system of lungs and heart on the one hand and renal system on the other is not in order, we will actually do best with iron if the situation truly is such. If it is such, however, that long-term disorders in these processes have caused organs to be deformed, with the sculpting activity unable to get down to these organs. That is, when organs have become deformed, have suffered from lack of sculpting activity, then we must use mercury, let us say. Mercury has inherent powers of form, the drop form retainable in the metal, which means it acts particularly on the lower organs in man. We can also establish certain connections between metals and the organs of the head, if attacked and deformed, let us say, when the nervous system itself has been impaired. In this case, it is, however, best not to depend wholly on establishing a stable balance as against a fluctuating balance. This is extraordinarily difficult. It is the way it would be with highly sensitive scales. We try everything to get the beam to balance, but it is really difficult. We will find it easier, however, if we do not just fiddle around with the beam, but with the scales. We can achieve this state of balance by supporting the iron action, for instance, by introducing something containing sulfur into the digestive tract and give it the counter effect with alkaline salts in the neurosensory organism. We then have iron effective in the middle, rhythmic human being. It will then disperse most beautifully, and potassium and calcium or alkaline salts active in the neurosensory organism, and the sulfur quality in the digestive rhythm. In that way, we manage better to establish the balance. It is most remarkable that we have the opposite situation in the leaves of certain plants. If you process the leaves of Urtica dioica in the right way, for example, they have to be the leaves of the ordinary stinging nettle, Urtica dioica, you'll have a medicament consisting of sulfur, iron, and the necessary salts that act in this way. You merely must be able truly to see together the devitalizing power in the plant and the vitalizing power in the human organism. It is actually the case that the whole sulfur process in the Urtica dioica root is gradually moving toward the inorganic. The human organism goes in the opposite direction, converting the sulfur via protein to such effect that it will gradually put the digestion to rights. The iron in Urtica dioica acts in a direction from the leaves that Urtica dioica throws apart also in the seed, and hence also in next year's leaves, the very principle which in the human organism brings together the rhythmic process. It is the opposite process in Urtica dioica. The attack coming from the leaves of this plant is a destructive element that must indeed be overcome if the rhythmic process in the human organism is to be put in order. And again, the alkaline salts in the plant are least transformed into inorganic matter, and therefore have the farthest to go, going up to the neurosensory organization, easily so. For, as we know, renal function is asleep and suppressed with the syndrome under consideration. In the human organism, we truly have a distribution which is the opposite of that perceived in an outward form in plant development. But it certainly is not necessary for us to limit ourselves to medicines based on plants. We can also make synthetic medicines by putting the substances to which I have just been referring together in suitable dosage and cure patients with these. These things can indeed gradually make therapy into a rational science and an art or skill, for it will not be wholly a science any more than you can be a sculptor without also being an artist. You may know a lot about how to handle the trowel, shape the clay, but something always results which is also artistic. We also cannot achieve therapy without this. We have to have it in hand, a mental or spiritual hand, of course, to establish the dosage. This is something which does not suit a great many people who want to make medicine into a pure science, but that is the way it is. Let me suggest what may also happen by means of an example. it may be the case that appropriate combined activity of the inorganic produced in the human organism in preparation for organizing things on the one hand, and intervention of the ether body of heart and lung function on the other, is disrupted. This disruption becomes more and more likely the older a person gets. The digestive tract and the vascular system are not working together as they should. We must then above all pay attention to the consequence, an accumulation of metabolic products. If the business does not spread through the organism as it should, we do of course have to deal with amassing of metabolic products. We enter into the whole field of metabolic diseases, from the mildest to the most severe forms. And we have to understand that kidney function is then also out of kilter, which is because it is not provided with anything to emanate, since it is all dammed up before this. And we are dealing with highly complicated forms of disease in that case. On the one hand, digestive and renal activity are not providing what is needed to have material for their sculpting activity. And on the other hand, deterioration of sculpting activity means that the organic balance is upset from the other side, so that sculpting activity is gradually also lost. The metabolic products spread out in the organism, and the power to get them into sculptured form, to use them as creative material, gradually ceases altogether. We then have the metabolic diseases that are really difficult to treat, and have to be treated by trying to take everything which may be said to be related to the process of becoming inorganic, that is, next door to the sulfur-like, phosphorus-like principles in flowers or connected to the volatile oils, and make it take effect in the digestive tract, and then also in the cardiopulmonary tract, so that we bring about renal activity in the organism, and so assist the sculpting powers. With this disease, it is of the greatest importance to be able to get at the digestive tract. Renal function and the production of sweat are polar opposites in some respect, intimately bound up with each other. And when renal function is not properly occupied by the things I have been characterizing, sweating activity will also regress. And this is something which merits special attention. Wherever sweating is not in order, renal function will also be out of order. Generally speaking, reduced sweating activity means that renal activity is like a machine that has nothing to process and yet goes on working. The materials coming from food have been dammed up before this and spread in the human organism in the wrong way. If we manage with courses of sulfur given externally or internally, we can influence this from either side, since we can act via the skin as well as via the kidneys to stimulate the digestive tract so much that it will on its own part stimulate cardiopulmonary activity, so that renal activity takes in the material again, receives it so that it does not get held somewhere else but is pushed into the renal activity. Then we may indeed manage to get control even of metabolic diseases. With all this, we must, however, clearly understand that in the human organism we are truly dealing with something that does not want to be fully healed, I'd say, but merely wants to be stimulated to heal itself. This is enormously important. In sickness, the human organism really wants to be stimulated to heal itself. To make the cure a lasting one, we really have to limit ourselves to providing the necessary stimuli. A cure that seems to proceed smoothly will more easily lead to relapses than a disease that is stimulated to heal. The organism has initially got used to the healing process and continues with it by its own activity. In this way, it connects much more closely with the healing process until the reaction comes up again. Initially, however, there is a kind of habituation. And if we adapt to the healing process in our organism for a time, that is the very best way of healing. For the organism then truly takes up the healing process that has been placed in it. All I have been able to do in this way is to make some suggestions as to method. But you will see that it is a matter of being really serious now in letting spiritual science cast light on physiology, pathology, and therapy. The human being does not exist in isolation, but is part of the whole cosmos. And if you have some process or other that takes a certain direction in the human being, say in an ascending curve, we must look for the descending curve outside the human being. We will be able to have a balancing effect on curves that rise too strongly, and so on. Medicine demands that, in a sense, you do already know the whole world. I was, of course, able to give you only a tiny segment, but this tiny segment will make you aware that you'll need to get to know Urtica dioica, Colchicum autumnala, or any other plant in a very different way from that generally required today. You have to see, as you look at the plant, where it seeks to go in its descending trend. So, if you come to Colchicum autumnala, you have to perceive that, first of all, the season when the plant appears has some significance for the whole structure. It establishes a certain relationship to devitalization. The color of the flower and the season indicate that very slight devitalization occurs in autumn crocus. If you then do your experiments as to how Colchicum autumnala might help, you'll find that the organism has to make efforts that go a long way to effect the opposite, vitalization, that is, to kill the plant off first and then bring it to life again, to put it in primitive terms. And the whole process goes all the way up to the human thyroid. And you can now do series of experiments to see how Colchicum autumnala becomes a medicine for goiter. Honestly, there is no question of complaining wildly in a dilettante way about modern scientific methods. No, it is a matter of indicating directions that will really lead to a more practical utilization than just trying things out. I do not in the least want to say that trying things out may not also take one to one's goal. It does also lead to goals. But many things escape us altogether. Above all, much escapes us of what we can learn from nature. It truly is good if we can synthetically produce a preparation of iron, sulfur, and alkali, if we know how nature herself brings them together synthetically in a certain way, so that we may also learn extraordinarily much for synthesis, if we understand what is going on in the natural world outside. It would indeed be fascinating to go into detail about various aspects. I think our medical friends will have done so for one thing or another in their lectures. Some of it may also be found in our literature. Some other things are such that I would hope to see them soon in our literature. For I am convinced that when these things are properly presented in our literature, people will take the standpoint where they say, well, to be a physician I must be able to heal, and so I'll also turn to something which at first goes against the grain. If it helps, I'll not be able to reject what is written in that literature as well. And so I think it would be good for us to have as soon as possible a literature covering the science of the spirit and the science based on the evidence of the senses. This will help us so that the opinion will be, yes, it does help, and so it cannot be such dreadful nonsense after all. And I am quite convinced that once the matter has really got going, the opinion will be, it helps, and that is what I would wish to rely on. Try it, and you'll see that it helps. And it will also be of some importance, for among the things used in official medicine are many, after all, that do not help. And the struggle between things that do not help and those that do will be where they must take place, which we do so very much desire to see from the point of view of spiritual science. The end of Lecture 8.